Sometimes wearing someone else's style is very comforting, warm and pretty and bright, and it can loosen you up, tune you into the joys of language and rhythm and concern. But what you say will be an abstraction, because it will not have sprung from direct experience. When you try to capture the truth of your experience in some other person's voice or on that person's terms, you're removing yourself one step further from what you have seen and what you know. Truth, or reality, or whatever you want to call it, is the bedrock of life. A black man at my church who was nearing 100 thundered last Sunday, "God is your home." And I pass this on mostly because all of the interesting characters I've ever worked with, including myself, have had at their center a feeling of otherness, of homesickness. And it's wonderful to watch someone finally open that forbidden door that has kept him or her away. What gets exposed is not people's baseness, but their humanity. It turns out that the truth, or reality, is our home. Look at the two extremes. Maybe you find truth in Samuel Beckett, that we're very much alone, and it's all scary and annoying, and it smells like dirty feet, and the most you can hope for is that periodically someone will offer a hand or a rag or a tiny word of encouragement just when you're going under. The redemption in Beckett is so small. In the second act of Waiting for Godot, the barren, dying twig of a tree has put out a leaf, just one leaf. It's not much. Still, Beckett didn't commit suicide. He wrote. Or, maybe truth as you understand it, is 180 degrees away, that God is everywhere, and we're all where we're supposed to be, and more will be revealed one day. Maybe you feel that Wordsworth was right. Maybe Rumi, maybe Stephen Mitchell, writing on Job. The physical body is acknowledged as dust. The personal drama as delusion. It is as if the world we perceive through our senses, that whole gorgeous and terrible pageant, were the breath-thin surface of a bubble, and everything else, inside and outside, is pure radiance. Both suffering and joy come then like a brief reflection, and death like a pin. But you can't get to any of these truths by sitting in a field, smiling beatifically, avoiding your anger and damage and grief. Your anger and damage and grief are the way to the truth. We don't have much truth to express unless we've gone into those rooms and closets and woods and abysses that we were told not to go into. When we've gone in and looked around for a long while, just breathing and finally taking it in, then we will be able to speak in our own voice and to stay in the present moment. And that moment is home. Giving. Annie Dillard has said that day by day, you have to give the work before you all the best stuff you have, not saving up for later projects. If you give freely, there will always be more. This is a radical proposition that runs so contrary to human nature, or at least to my nature, that I personally keep trying to find loopholes in it. But it is only when I go ahead and decide to shoot my literary creative wad on a daily basis that I get any sense of full presence, of being Zorba the Greek at the keyboard. Otherwise, I'm a wired little rodent squirreling things away, hoarding and worrying about supply. Arthritis forms in my hands, and in the hands my mind is using to shape things, in the hands of that creature in the cellar who wants and needs to use all of his favorite rags in the rag bag he works from. You're going to have to give and give and give, or there's no reason for you to be writing. You have to give from the deepest part of yourself, and you're going to have to go on giving, and the giving is going to have to be its own reward. There is no cosmic importance to your getting something published, but there is in learning to be a giver. Your work as a writer, when you're giving everything you have to your characters and to your readers, will periodically make you feel like the single parent of a 3-year-old, who is, by turns, wonderful, willful, terrible, crazed, and adoring. Toddlers can make you feel as if you violated some archaic law in their personal Quran, and you should die, infidel. Other times, they'll reach out and touch you like adoring grandparents on their deathbeds, trying to memorize your face with their fingers. One night I was lying in bed with Sam when he was about 3 1/2, and he touched my cheeks tenderly, as if they were sunburned. I love that little face, he said. And I felt like in a moment he might squeeze my cheeks and exclaim, Mein schöner Poonam, my beautiful face. And then the next day, Sam was treating me like I was the bunny at his own private Playboy club, and he had run out of drinks half an hour before. But they're always yours, your books, as well as your children. You helped bring your work into being, and every day you have to feed it, help it stay well, give it advice, and love it when it ignores you. Your three-year-old and your work in progress teach you to give. They teach you to get out of yourself and become a person for someone else. This is probably the secret to happiness. So that's one reason to write. Your child and your work hold you hostage, suck you dry, ruin your sleep, mess with your head, treat you like dirt, and then you discover they've given you that gold nugget you were looking for all along. Two things put me in the spirit to give. One is that I have come to think of almost everyone with whom I come into contact as a patient in the emergency room. I see a lot of gaping wounds and dazed expression, or, as Marianne Moore put it, the world's an orphan's home. And this feels more true than almost anything else I know. But so many of us can be soothed by writing. Think of how many times you've opened a book, read one line, and said, yes. And I want to give people that feeling, too, of connection, communion. The other is to think of the writers who have given a book to me, and then to write a book back to them. This gift they have given us, which we pass on to those around us, was fashioned out of their lives. You wouldn't be a writer if reading hadn't enriched your soul more than other pursuits. So, write a book back to V.S. Naipaul, or Margaret Atwood, or Wendell Berry, or whoever it is who most made you want to write, whose work you most love to read. Make it as good as you can. It is one of the greatest feelings known to humans. The feeling of being the host, of hosting people, of being the person to whom they come for food and drink and company. This is what the writer has to offer. Here's the best true story on giving I know. And it was told by Jack Kornfield of the Spirit Rock Meditation Center in Woodacre. An 8-year-old boy had a younger sister who was dying of leukemia, and he was told that without a blood transfusion, she would die. His parents explained to him that his blood was probably compatible with hers, and if so, he could be the blood donor. They asked him if they could test his blood. He said sure. So they did, and it was a good match. Then they asked if he would give his sister a pint of blood, that it could be her only chance of living. He said he would have to think about it overnight. The next day, he went to his parents and said he was willing to donate the blood. So they took him to the hospital where he was put on a gurney beside his 6-year-old sister. Both of them were hooked up to IVs. A nurse withdrew a pint of blood from the boy, which was then put into the girl's IV. The boy lay on his gurney in silence while the blood dripped into his sister, until the doctor came over to see how he was doing. Then the boy opened his eyes and asked, "How soon until I start to die?" Sometimes you have to be that innocent to be a writer. Writing takes a combination of sophistication and innocence. It takes conscience, our belief that something is beautiful because it's right. To be great, art has to point somewhere. So if you are no longer familiar with that place of naive conscience, it's hard to see any point in your being a writer. Almost all of my close friends are walking personality disorders, but I know innocence is in them because I can see it in their faces and in their decisions. I can almost promise that this quality is still in you, that you're capable of quiet heroism. This sophisticated innocence is a gift. It is yours to give away. We're wired as humans to be open to the world instead of enclosed in a fortified defensive mentality. What your giving can do is to help your readers be braver, be better than they are, be open to the world again. One does not need to be optimistic in order to do this. My priest friend, Rankin, for instance, describes himself as a cheerful pessimist, and this attitude is enough to rescue him from the bleakness that would otherwise have him physically curled up in the fetal position. Now, Come to think of it, this autism is a great position for one of your characters to end up in near the climax because the killing of this deadness is a great theme. In real life, most people don't actually curl up in the fetal position in order to tune out their feelings. Most people get strung out on relationships with other people or on work or drugs or alcohol or food, but a similar trance is induced. You may find that your character is not well enough for this deadness to be killed, or at least not ready yet. Heaven knows punishment and trance are a great deal more comfortable and familiar than aliveness. It's like that old joke about denial. A woman goes to the zoo and is completely taken by the beauty and power of the gorilla. She cannot take her eyes off him. He is sleeping against the bars of the cage, and even though a sign says not to, she reaches her hand in to stroke him. Instantly, he awakes and goes berserk, tearing the bars of the cage open to get at her, mauling her to within an inch of her life. Finally, the zoo personnel manage to hit him with the tranquilizer darts. The woman is taken to an ICU, barely alive, but slowly, slowly, she pulls through. After 4 days, she is finally allowed visitors. Her best friend arrives. The woman can barely open her eyes. "God, you look like you're in a lot of pain," the friend says. And the woman sighs. "Pain." She says, "You don't know pain." He doesn't call. He doesn't write. This is one of my favorite jokes because the character is so familiar to me. She's probably familiar to a lot of people you know. Maybe she is not ready for the deadness to be killed. Or maybe against all odds she is. Maybe you can give her something from deep within to find, or do, or fight for that will break the trance for her. You'll have to find this first within you, though, and then you'll have to give it away. This woman may get to wake up, and then she will have something to give, a song to sing. Maybe it won't be a song exactly, but maybe just a little tune, a calliope tune. The tune of survival. Publication. All right, let's talk about publication. Let's talk about the myth of publication. Say you finish your book, or a draft of the book, or a whole lot of stories, and you send them off to your agent, if you have one, or to a friend's agent, or to an agent you found listed in the Yellow Pages or in the literary marketplace. Say you actually already have an editor somewhere, or an editor who once wrote you an admiring rejection letter, so you send your book or stories to him or her and to a couple of friends. As I've mentioned, I'm one of those people who feels beside herself the day after I've stuck the manuscript in the mail. It can't have even arrived, and already I'm feeling bitter and resentful about what cold, lazy, sadistic slime I'm surrounded by. There are other writers, and you may be one of them, who just push back their sleeves and get to work on the next piece. I could never be close to a person like this, but I know they exist. Anyway, if you're like me, you wait and wait and check your mail 10 times each day and feel devastated and rejected every hour that there is no response. Finally, if you're lucky, a week later you get a note from your agent's assistant that the manuscript has in fact arrived and maybe one of the friends has called to say that he or she has read part of it and that it is just terrific and not to worry. But you go ahead and have a small breakdown anyway, waiting for your agent and editor to call and tell you that it's brilliant. Every time the phone rings, you sing, "Let it please be him. Oh, dear God, it must be him." But it's not him. And then you die and go on a massive eating binge and think about what phonies most of your friends are. And then you calm down. You go for a walk. You're a little better. Then you try to read something. But you end up reading your own manuscript and reeling with shame at how bad it is. But just when you start to go into actual spasm, your friend calls back and says he's just read another chapter and really, on the souls of his grandchildren, he swears it's the best thing you've ever written. He loves it. And he loves you. So, you're okay again for a good 10 minutes or so. After another week, you call your agent because you can't stand pretending to be cool anymore, but your agent hasn't read your manuscript yet because he is swamped with infinitely more important matters. He tells you with the faintest hint of irritation that the very second he finishes it or hears from your editor, you will be called, and that everything is probably just fine. Okay, the agent asks, all better? You want to go rip his face off. Instead, you pray. And then you see in a flash of blinding insight that your agent and editor are in cahoots, and what you heard as irritation was really just the strain of withholding hysterics. After being on the phone all morning reading each other passages from your book, they agree that it is the most embarrassingly bad book ever written, and they're honking and screaming with laughter. At one point, your editor is laughing so hard that she has to take some digitalis, and your agent ruptures a blood vessel in his throat. They're reading the scene to each other where your hero's father dies. And if you actually have a contract with these people, you assume that your editor has to get off the phone at this point so that he can go talk to the legal department to see if they have to pay you the last part of the advance they owe you, or if maybe they can even sue you to collect the money they've already paid you. But all you can do is wait and wait and wait until finally your agent or editor calls and says the book is terrific and it will be published in the spring or the fall or whenever. It will be published. And then there are some happy months. Rewriting, editing, working with the copy editor, loved and reassured every step of the way. And then there is the utter miracle of galleys, where your book comes to you set in type and it looks like a real person was involved in writing it. Many non-writers assume that publication is a thunderously joyous event in the writer's life, and it is certainly the biggest and brightest carrot dangling before the eyes of my students. They believe that if they themselves were to get something published, their lives would change instantly, dramatically, and for the better. Their self-esteem would flourish. All self-doubt would be erased like a typo. Entire paragraphs and manuscripts of disappointment and rejection and lack of faith would be wiped out by one push of a psychic delete button and replaced by a quiet, tender sense of worth and belonging. Then they could wrap the world in flame. But this is not exactly what happens. Or at any rate, this is not what it has been like for me. For me, it has been more like a cross between the last few weeks of pregnancy, when you look and feel like Orson Welles and you're hormonally challenged up the yang, your ankles are swollen and you feel revulsion at the smell of vegetables cooking, and the first day of seventh grade PE class, when they make you line up by size before they hand out your gym uniform. And you're either 4 feet tall, like E.T., or made to feel like Diane Arbus's Jewish giant. Ooh, the process starts off well enough. One day, several months before your pub date, you get a set of bound galleys, which is to say, a paper-bound book with your manuscript set in type. I always feel a desperate sense of relief at this point, because it seems like the publisher is too far in now to cancel publication. These bound galleys have also gone out to hundreds of papers and reviewers, and this makes you believe that the publisher has already shelled out so much money in production and postage costs that they will have to go ahead and actually publish the damn thing. The first time you read through your galleys is heaven. Second time through, all you see are the typos no one caught. It looks like the typesetter typed it with frostbitten feet, drunk. And the typos are important ones. They make you look ignorant. They make you look like an ignorant racist. By the third or fourth time through, you can see that there is not one fresh or insightful or even salvageable line in the whole thing. By the fifth reading, you are no longer sure that publishing this would be in your best interests. Not long after, you get your early reviews in Publishers Weekly and Kirkus Reviews, and sometimes they sound like your mother wrote them. Other times, they suggest that you are a show-offy, vacuous loser, and they hope you die so that they won't have to read your work anymore. I have gotten pre-pub reviews that said I was a treadmark on the underpants of life. Perhaps this is not exactly what they said, but by reading between the lines, I could see that this is what they were implying. You survive that. Possibly you're still drinking, so you have a pitcher of martinis just to take the edge off, or you've quit drinking, so you eat your body weight in pastries and Mexican food. Somehow, you get the time to pass, and then your pub date arrives. There is something mythic about the date of publication, and you actually come to believe that on this one particular morning, you will wake up to a phone ringing off the hook, and your publisher will be so excited that they will have hired the Blue Angels precision flying team to buzz your squalid little hovel, which you will be moving out of as soon as sales of the book really take off. Or at least, they will remember to send flowers. I remember one year my friend Carpenter and I had books out on the same day. We talked about it all summer. We pretended to have modest expectations. I had modest expectations for his book. He had modest expectations for mine. The week before, we talked almost every morning about how excited we were and what a long time we had waited and how it was just like being a little kid waiting for Christmas Eve. Finally, the big day arrived, and I woke up happy, embarrassed in advance by all the praise and attention that would be forthcoming. I made coffee and practiced digging my toe in the dirt and called Pammy and a few friends to let them congratulate me. Then I waited for the phone to ring. The phone did not know its part. It sat there silent as death with a head cold. By noon, the noise of it not ringing began to wear badly on my nerves. Luckily, though, by noon it was time for the first beer of the day. I sat by the phone like a loyal dog, waiting for it to ring. Finally, finally, it rang at 4. I picked up the phone and heard Carpenter laughing hysterically like some serial killer, and then I became hysterical, and eventually we both had to be sedated. He sent me flowers, and before I knew he had done so, I sent him flowers, too. The ones he sent me were so beautiful, roses and irises mostly. This is often pretty much what it is like, except for the part about the roses and irises. I tell you, if what you have in mind is fame and fortune, publication is going to drive you crazy. If you're lucky, you will get a few reviews, some good, some bad, some indifferent. Don't even get me started on the places where one is neglected. There will be a few book signing parties and maybe some readings, at one of which your publisher will spring for a 20-pound wheel of runny brie, and the only person who will show has lived on the street since he was 12, and even he will leave because he hates brie. You and the people who work at the bookstore will make lots of hilarious jokes about this. You will read to the 5 of them, and they will respond with great enthusiasm. Maybe there will be a couple of interviews, and then probably somewhere along the line, just when you thought things were settling down, your first really devastating review, the review that says your book is dog do. It is especially festive when this review is in the local press so that all your relatives can read it, too. You can just picture several 100,000 people perusing the review over their morning coffee, reading it out loud to one another and chuckling about how clever the reviewer is. So you rant and you cry, and then your writer friends call and commiserate. And they really do feel sick for you and angry, and they know you feel like a wounded animal, a raging bull, and they say the right things. That they love you and they love your book, and that it has happened to them a year ago or whenever. Because if you are a writer, it is going to happen to you. This is the truth. It has happened to me, and if you get published, it is almost certainly going to happen to you. But the fact of publication is the acknowledgement from the community that you did your writing right. You acquire a rank that you never lose. Now you're a published writer, and you are in that rare position of getting to make a living, such as it is, doing what you love best. That knowledge does bring you a quiet joy. But eventually you have to sit down like every other writer and face the blank page. The beginnings of a second or third book are full of spirit and confidence because you've been published, and false starts and terror because now you have to prove yourself again. People may find out that you were a flash in the pan, that it was all beginner's luck. What I know now is that you have to wear out all that dread by writing long and hard and not stopping too often to admire yourself and your publishedness in the mirror. Sometime later, you'll find yourself at work on, maybe really into, another book, and once again you figure out that the real payoff is the writing itself, that a day when you have gotten your work done is a good day, that total dedication is the point. When is she going to talk about joy? The people in the back row whine. Haven't I? I certainly meant to mention that good hours at the desk are as wonderful as any I can imagine. But joy for me is Sam and my church and my buddies and family, and more often it is felt outdoors and at my desk. There is a part of me that resists saying that I love being a published writer, that it has been a dream come true, first of all because it is so much more complicated than that, and second, I don't want unpublished writers to throw up their hands and say, "See, okay, I rest my case. Publishing is the great reward." But the truth is that there can be a great deal of satisfaction in being a writer, in being a person who gets some work done most days and who has been published and acknowledged. I carry this around in my pocket, touch it a number of times a day to make sure it is still there. Even though so much of my writing time is stressful and disheartening, I carry a secret sense of accomplishment around with me, like a radium pack implanted near my heart that now leeches a quiet sense of relief through my system. But you pay through the nose for this. No one has expressed it better than a great novelist I heard once on a talk show who said something like, You want to know the price I pay for being a writer? Okay, I'll tell you. I travel by plane a great deal, and I'm usually seated next to some huge businessman who works on files or his laptop computer for a while, and then notices me and asks me what I do. And I say, I'm a writer. Then there's always a terrible silence. Then he says eagerly, have you written anything I might have heard of? And that's the price I pay for being a writer. My own version of this is that the other day, Sam and I were at the mall. I had a big event coming up on stage at the Herbst Theater because I had just had a book published that was getting a lot of attention. I decided to buy a new dress for the evening. So the two of us were just innocently walking around the store when the owner came up to me. She said, are you looking for anything in particular? I said, well, I have a special occasion coming up and I need a new dress. She said, is it for a dinner party? I said, no, actually, I'm doing something on stage. She said, are you a singer? And I felt the jungle drums start to beat, warning me to keep my mouth shut, warning me to send my ego to its room, but I had gotten used to the attention. I cleared my throat and towed the carpet and said, no, I'm a writer. She said, oh, wow, I read absolutely everything. Tell me your name. I knew I was in trouble. I knew I was going to get nailed, but my ego had become Nelson Rockefeller, and it felt like mingling. My wiser self knew I was already too far in to stop now. I said, no, you won't have heard of me, and it'll make me feel terrible. She stood firm. Honest, she said, I read everything. Part of me believed I had become so famous that when I told her my name, she'd react as if Paul McCartney had just dropped into her store. The wiser part of me knew I was a goner for sure. I started to pray at that point, only I was praying to her, please, please don't make me tell you my name. I smiled demurely, like we'd had our fun and I'd better go get Sam, who was hiding under a rack of dresses making rude noises. Beth, Beth, the shop owner called out suddenly, come here. A young woman stepped out from the back room with an expectant look on her face. Beth, the owner said, don't I read everything? Tell her. Beth said, yes, yes, this is true. She reads everything. Then the owner looked at me kindly and said, now come on, what's your name? I sighed, smiled, and finally said, Anne Lamott. She stared at me with great concern. The room was very quiet, except for Sam under the dress rack. Then she pursed her lips and slowly shook her head. No, she said. I guess not. It took me about a week and a great deal of cheap chocolate to get over that. But then I remembered that whenever the world throws rose petals at you, which thrill and seduce the ego, beware. The cosmic banana peel is suddenly going to appear underfoot to make sure you don't take it all too seriously, that you don't fill up on junk food. All that I know about the relationship between publication and mental health was summed up in one line of the movie Cool Runnings, which is about the first Jamaican bobsled team. The coach is a 400-pound man who had won a gold in Olympic bobsledding 20 years before, but has been a complete loser ever since. The men on his team are desperate to win an Olympic medal, just as half the people in my classes are desperate to get published. But the coach says, if you're not enough before the gold medal, you won't be enough with it. You may want to tape this to the wall near your desk. The banana peel has appeared almost every time I've scored a triumph, or what the world would regard as a triumph. It's God as coyote prankster. Just last week, for instance, I was participating in this illustrious literary event in San Francisco for a national charity. I had waited for years to be included in this event, each year watching six other writers be selected. I had tried to be a good sport about it, God knows I had. I understood that the organizers needed to invite big-time, nationally known writers so as to draw the biggest possible crowd. This made perfect sense. But year after year, I felt dejected each time I was not included. Finally, this year, I was asked, and my joy was boundless. Now, I'm not stupid. I knew it was a nice big plate of cocaine for my ego. I knew it was another golden calf, but still, my baby heart soared like an eagle. However, there was this one tiny little problem. I was the last author to be asked and to commit, so I wasn't on the initial press release that went out 3 months ago. The publicity chairwoman sent out a second release after I came on board, but when the first big prominent mention was made in the paper a few weeks ago, my name wasn't included. I was miffed, since it was the most important column in the paper, but I am old and tough and can handle this sort of disappointment. Next, there was a paragraph about the event in the book section, and once again I was not included. This time the publicity chairwoman called, upset and so full of apologies that she managed to mollify me. Then there was a big mention in the society pages, and guess what? It felt like seventh grade all over again. The publicity chairwoman called again and was so upset that I thought she might actually drink a big glass of Drano right there on the phone. I felt suddenly so teary and premenstrual and left out that I couldn't even talk about it. Hours later, I remembered that if I wasn't enough before being asked to participate in this prestigious event, then participating wasn't going to make me enough. Being enough was going to have to be an inside job. Also, about an hour after I had slogged through to this conclusion, my mouth dropped open. I had somehow forgotten that it was a charity event. I had come to see it as a sort of showcase for me. Funny how that happens. I finally smiled, remembering something I heard Ram Dass say on the radio once, about somebodyism. How most of us are raised to be somebodies, and what a no-win game that is to buy into, because while you may turn out to be much more somebody than somebody else, a lot of other people are going to be a lot more somebody than you, and you're going to drive yourself crazy. One more thing about publication. When this book of mine came out, the one that did pretty well, the one that necessitated the buying of a new dress, I found myself stoned on all the attention and then lost and derailed, needing a new fix every couple of days, and otherwise going into withdrawal. My insides became completely uninhabitable, as if I'd wandered into a penny arcade with lots of bells ringing and lights flashing and lots of junk food, and I'd been there too long. I wanted peace, peace and quiet, but at the same time, I didn't want to leave. I was like one of the bad boys in Pinocchio who flocked to the island of pleasure and grow donkey ears. I knew my soul was sick and that I needed spiritual advice, and I knew also that this advice shouldn't be terribly sophisticated. So, I went to see the pastor of my son's preschool. The pastor is about 15. We talked for a while. It turns out he just looks young. I said that I was all over the place, up and down, scattered, high, withdrawing, lost, and in the midst of it all, trying to find some elusive sense of serenity. The world can't give that serenity, he said. The world can't give us peace. We can only find it in our hearts. I hate that, I said. I know. But the good news is that, by the same token, the world can't take it away. Part 5. The Last Class. There are so many things I want to tell my students in our last class. So many things I want to remind them of. Write about your childhoods, I tell them for the umpteenth time. Write about that time in your life when you were so intensely interested in the world, when your powers of observation were at their most acute, when you felt things so deeply. Exploring and understanding your childhood will give you the ability to empathize, and that understanding and empathy will teach you to write with intelligence and insight and compassion. Becoming a writer is about becoming conscious. When you're conscious and writing from a place of insight and simplicity and real caring about the truth, you have the ability to throw the lights on for your reader. He or she will recognize his or her life and truth in what you say, in the pictures you've painted, and this decreases the terrible sense of isolation that we have all had too much of. Try to write in a directly emotional way instead of being too subtle or oblique. Don't be afraid of your material or your past. Be afraid of wasting any more time obsessing about how you look and how people see you. Be afraid of not getting your writing done. If something inside you is real, we will probably find it interesting, and it will probably be universal. So you must risk placing real emotion at the center of your work. Write straight into the emotional center of things, right toward vulnerability. Don't worry about appearing sentimental. Worry about being unavailable. Worry about being absent or fraudulent. Risk being unliked. Tell the truth as you understand it. If you're a writer, you have a moral obligation to do this. And it is a revolutionary act. truth is always subversive. Ethan Kanan insists that you should never write out of vengeance, while I tell my students that they should always write out of vengeance, as long as they do so nicely. If someone has crossed them, if someone has treated them too roughly, I urge them to write about it. Two of my students, in different sessions, decided to write about the switches that their parents selected from backyard trees and with which their parents used to beat them. Use these memories, I told them. They're yours. This should not have happened to you. Personally, I would write about this partly out of a longing to make sense of it all and partly out of vengeance. And this, I tell my students, may be as good a time as any to discuss libel. Libel is defamation by written or printed word. It is knowingly, maliciously saying things about people that cast them in a false or damaging light. This means that if you lived with a man who had a number of curious personal and professional habits and circumstances that his friends and clients happen to know about, and if these friends can identify this man in your work by these habits and circumstances, you should probably change the details dramatically. If he was famous for having long toenails, make them nasal hairs instead. If he dyed his hair black, have him use foundation instead and maybe the merest hint of blusher. However, if he revealed himself through his actions toward you to be a sociopathic narcissist, you can attempt to capture his character and use actual conversations, just as long as this specific man is not identifiable by your descriptions. Change everything that would point to him specifically. Leave out his kleptomaniac leanings. Leave out the kind of car he really drove, and the fact that he hated smokers so much that he planted a tiny tree in the ashtray. Make yourself the first wife or the girlfriend instead of the third wife, and do not include his offensive children, especially the red-haired twins. If you disguise this person carefully so that he cannot be recognized by the physical or professional facts of his life, you can use him in your work. And the best advice I can give you is to give him a teeny little penis, so he will be less likely to come forth. I know this makes me sound a little angry. I had a student whose mother, as punishment, used to burn him on the stove in the kitchen when he was little. Use it, I told him. She's old, though, he said. Her life has not been a happy one. My heart bleeds, I told him. Change her looks, age, where you lived. If you were an only child, make up 5 other kids. If there were 3 kids in your family, have the narrator be an only child. Make her a single mother. Use the bad dad somewhere else in another story. If there was no dad, make one up. This guy has written some beautiful stories about his childhood, with a mother who physically bears absolutely no resemblance to his own. She now has blonde hair and big, warm brown eyes, worked at the A&P, and held her son's hand to the flame when he was naughty. One time when he finished reading, the class burst into spontaneous applause. A friend of mine recently fell for this non-Catholic priest who seemed very learned and spiritual and tender in the beginning, and then turned out to be a mean little Napoleonic shit. Not to put too fine a point on it. She wondered if she could use him as a character. Oh, I said, I insist. Do I have to make him tall so he won't sue me? No, I said. Make him an uneducated writer instead of a psychologist. Give him a past, 2 wives, and a number of kids he hasn't seen in years. Make him homely. Make him a smoker. Make him an atheist. Give him a penis that looks like a tiny little egg in a bird's nest. He isn't going to come forward. Maybe this is not only vengeance. Maybe it is just wanting to tell the truth as it really happened. Maybe it is also about trying to find some meaning in the suffering. Well, whatever. Here is a poem by Sharon Olds called I Go Back to May 1937 that I pass out to every class. I see them standing at the formal gates of their colleges. I see my father strolling out under the ochre sandstone arch, the red tiles glinting like bent plates of blood behind his head. I see my mother with a few light books at her hip, standing at the pillar made of tiny bricks, with a wrought iron gate still open behind her, its sword tips black in the May air. They're about to graduate. They are about to get married. They are kids. They are dumb. All they know is they are innocent. They would never hurt anybody. I want to go up to them and say, stop. Don't do it. She's the wrong woman. He's the wrong man. You are going to do things you cannot imagine you would ever do. You are going to do bad things to children. You're going to suffer in ways you never heard of. You're going to want to die. I want to go up to them there in the late May sunlight and say it. Her hungry, pretty blank face turning to me, her pitiful, beautiful, untouched body, his arrogant, handsome, blind face turning to me, his pitiful, beautiful, untouched body, but I don't do it. I want to live. I take them up like the male and female paper dolls and bang them together at the hips like chips of flint, as if to strike sparks from them. I say, do what you're going to do, and I will tell about it. I know that if you write a novel about your marriage, and your spouse is a public figure, a politician, say, or a therapist, and you say really awful inflammatory things about this person, all of which may be true, including the part about his wearing the little French maid's outfit when you made love, and that awful business with the Brill cream, you will get a visit from your publisher's lawyer, who will be very anxious and unamused. The problem is that the publishing house will be liable for millions of dollars in damages if this spouse of yours can convince a jury that he or she has been libeled. The best solution is not only to disguise and change as many characteristics as you can, but also to make the fictional person a composite. Then throw in the teeny little penis and anti-Semitic leanings, and I think you'll be okay. Try not to feel sorry for yourselves, I say, when you find the going hard and lonely. You seem to want to write. So write. You didn't have to sign up for this class. I didn't chase you down and drag you by the hair back to my cave. You are lucky to be one of those people who wishes to build sandcastles with words, who is willing to create a place where your imagination can wander. We build this place with the sand of memories. These castles are our memories and inventiveness made tangible. So part of us believes that when the tide starts coming in, we won't really have lost anything, because actually only a symbol of it was there in the sand. Another part of us thinks we'll figure out a way to divert the ocean. This is what separates artists from ordinary people. The belief deep in our hearts that if we build our castles well enough, somehow the ocean won't wash them away. I think this is a wonderful kind of person to be. Now, there is only a little time left in the class, and it feels like that last half hour at camp when you've all gathered in the parking lot, waiting for your duffel bags to be loaded on the bus. I think I've told my students every single thing I know about writing. Short assignments, shitty first drafts, one-inch picture frames, Polaroids, messes, mistakes, partners. But a lot of these people came to my class with the best 10 pages they've ever written, hoping to get published, and now they wonder if this was just a pipe dream. I don't think so. Maybe most of them are not going to be published in big magazines or by big presses. They're not going to end up on talk shows and bestseller lists, are not going to be David Letterman's best friend, or shows Sharon Stone a good time. They're not going to buy big houses and pedigreed dogs and fish forks as a result of their writing. Many of them want these things more than anything else. They don't believe that if they got these things, they'd probably end up even more mentally ill and full of stress and self-doubt than they already are. Anyway, it is not going to happen for very many of them. I still think they should write with everything they have, daily if possible, and for the rest of their lives. When I suggest, however, that devotion and commitment will be their own reward, that in dedication to their craft they will find solace and direction and wisdom and truth and pride, they at first look at me with great hostility. You might think that I had just offered them membership in my embroidery club. They are angry people. This is why they write. So let me go further. There are a lot of us, some published, some not, who think the literary life is the loveliest one possible, this life of reading and writing and corresponding. We think this life is nearly ideal. It is spiritually invigorating, says a friend, who converted at 18 from Christianity to poetry. It is intellectually quickening. One can find in writing a perfect focus for life. It offers challenge and delight and agony and commitment. We see our work as a vocation, with the potential to be as rich and enlivening as the priesthood. As a writer, one will have, over the years, many experiences that stimulate and nourish the spirit. These will be quiet and deep inside, however, unaccompanied by thunder or tremulous angels. My friend Tom, the gay Jesuit priest, said that he has longed for spiritual experiences all his life, but that when he was drinking, he longed specifically to go into a church and have the statue of Mary wave back at him. And sometimes it did, when he was drinking. Just quick little waves, and then she'd sit down. But after he got sober, he could tell he'd had a genuine experience when he'd feel a sense of liberation afterward in his chest, his lungs, his soul. This feeling is something my students report, especially those in writing groups, this feeling of liberation that, ironically, discipline brings. Becoming a writer can also profoundly change your life as a reader. One reads with a deeper appreciation and concentration, knowing how hard writing is, especially how hard it is to make it look effortless. You begin to read with a writer's eyes. You focus in a new way. You study how someone portrays his or her version of things in a way that is new and bold and original. You notice how a writer paints in a mesmerizing character or era for you, without your having the sense of being given a whole lot of information. And when you realize how artfully this has happened, you may actually put the book down for a moment and savor it, just taste it. There are moments when I am writing when I think that if other people knew how I felt right now, they'd burn me at the stake for feeling so good, so full, so much intense pleasure. I pay through the nose for these moments, of course, with lots of torture and self-loathing and tedium, but when I'm done for the day, I have something to show for it. When the ancient Egyptians finished building the pyramids, they had built the pyramids. Perhaps they are good role models. They thought they were working for God, so they worked with a sense of concentration and religious awe. Also, my friend Carpenter tells me, they drank all day and took time off every few hours to oil each other. I believe that all my other writer friends do this too, but they won't let me in on it. The society to which we belong seems to be dying, or is already dead. I don't mean to sound dramatic, but clearly the dark side is rising. Things could have not been more odd and frightening in the Middle Ages. But the tradition of artists will continue no matter what form the society takes. And this is another reason to write. People need us, to mirror for them and for each other without distortion, not to look around and say, "Look at yourselves, you idiots," but to say, "This is who we are." In this dark and wounded society, writing can give you the pleasures of the woodpecker, of hollowing out a hole in a tree where you can build your nest and say, "This is my niche. This is where I live now. This is where I belong." And the niche may be small and dark, but at last you will finally know what you're doing. After 30 years or more of floundering around and screwing up, you will finally know. And when you get serious, you will be dealing with the one thing you've been avoiding all along. Your wounds. This is very painful. It stops a lot of people early on who didn't get into this for the pain. They got into it for the money and the fame. So they either quit or they resort to a type of writing that is sort of like candy making. Don't underestimate this gift of finding a place in the writing world. If you really work at describing creatively on paper the truth as you understand it, as you have experienced it, with the people or material who are in you, who are asking that you help them get written, you will come to a secret feeling of honor. Being a writer is part of a noble tradition, as is being a musician, the last egalitarian and open associations. No matter what happens in terms of fame and fortune, dedication to writing is a marching step forward from where you were before, when you didn't care about reaching out to the world, when you weren't hoping to contribute, when you were just standing there doing some job into which you had fallen. Even if only the people in your writing group read your memoirs or stories or novel, even if you only wrote your story so that one day your children would know what life was like when you were a child, and you knew the name of every dog in town, still, to have written your version is an honorable thing to have done. Against all odds, you have put it down on paper so that it won't be lost. And who knows? Maybe what you've written will help others, will be a small part of the solution. You don't even have to know how or in what way, but if you are writing the clearest, truest words you can find and doing the best you can to understand and communicate, this will shine on paper like its own little lighthouse. Lighthouses don't go running all over an island looking for boats to save. They just stand there, shining. You simply keep putting down one damn word after the other, as you hear them, as they come to you. You can either set brick as a laborer or as an artist. You can make the work a chore, or you can have a good time. You can do it the way you used to clear the dinner dishes when you were 13, or you can do it as a Japanese person would perform a tea ceremony, with a level of concentration and care in which you can lose yourself, and so in which you can find yourself. Sometimes, no matter how screwed up things seem, I feel like we're all at a wedding. But you can't just come out and say, "We're at a wedding! Have some cake!" You need to create a world into which we can enter. A world where we can see this. There was an old desert dog in a comic strip yesterday, sitting with his back against a cactus, writing a letter to his brother that said, "At night the sun goes down, and the stars come out, and then in the morning, the sun comes up again. It's so exciting to live in the desert." That's the wedding, right? To participate requires self-discipline and trust and courage, because this business of becoming conscious of being a writer is ultimately about asking yourself, as my friend Dale puts it, how alive am I willing to be? The best thing about being an artist instead of a madman or someone who writes letters to the editor is that you get to engage in satisfying work. Even if you never publish a word, you have something important to pour yourself into. Your parents and grandparents will be shouting, "Don't do it! Don't sit down! Don't sit down!" And you'll have to do what you did as a kid. Shut them out and get on with finding out about life. Then I look into my students' faces, and they look solemnly back at me. "So, why does our writing matter again?" they ask. "Because of the spirit," I say. "Because of the heart. Writing and reading decrease our sense of isolation. They deepen and widen and expand our sense of life. They feed the soul. When writers make us shake our heads with the exactness of their prose and their truths and even make us laugh about ourselves, our life, our buoyancy is restored. We're given a shot at dancing with, or at least clapping along with, the absurdity of life instead of being squashed by it over and over again. It's like singing on a boat during a terrible storm at sea. You can't stop the raging storm. But singing can change the hearts and spirits of the people who are together on that ship.
The end. You've been listening to Bird by Bird, Some Instructions on Writing and Life, by Anne Lamott. Narrated by Susan Bennett and directed by Ezra Tenenbaum. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends How to Read and Why, by Harold Bloom, narrated by John McDonough. Harold Bloom is Serling Professor of Humanities at Yale University, Berg Professor of English at New York University, and former Charles Eliot Norton Professor at Harvard. He has written more than 20 books of literary criticism. From a lifetime of writing and teaching about literature, this great scholar exhorts readers to consider the pleasures and benefits of reading well. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So visit us at recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.